And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's October the 13th. It's a cold day. It's the 286th day of the year. Only 79 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in history, and 54 A.D., Roman Emperor Claudius dies from poisoning under mysterious circumstances. He's succeeded by his adopted son, Nero, rather than by Britannicus, his son Messalina. For those that are wondering about Britannicus, for a time he was considered his father's heir, but that changed after his mother had a downfall in 48. It was revealed she'd engaged in a bigamous marriage without Claudius's knowledge. The next year, his father married Agrippina the Younger. That was Claudius's fourth and final marriage. That marriage was followed by the adoption of Agrippina's son, Lucius Domitius, whose name became Nero as a result. His stepbrother later be married to Britannicus's sister, Octavia, and soon eclipsed him as Claudius's heir. That's Britannicus's stepbrother. Following his father's death in October of the year 54, Nero became emperor. And shortly after his 14th birthday, Britannicus died, supposedly as a result of being poisoned on Nero's orders. He was definitely a threat to Nero's claim to the throne, since he was the natural son of Claudius. In the year 409, Vandals and Alans cross the Pyrenees and appear in Hispania. 1269, the present church building at Westminster Abbey is consecrated. 1307, hundreds of Knights Templars in France were arrested at dawn by King Philip the Fair, later confessed under torture to heresy. Now, basically, Philip the Fair wanted the Templar treasure. He, at one point, when the citizens of Paris had rioted, he had sought refuge with the Templars, and he saw the massive treasure they had in their strong rooms. So, conspiring with the Pope, he brought down the Templars on Friday, October the 13th, 1307. In 1332, Rasin Bai Khan becomes the Khagan of the Mongols and the Emperor of the Yuan Dynasty. He reigned for 53 days. 1399, coronation of Henry IV of England at Westminster Abbey. 1644, Swedish-Dutch fleet defeats the Danish fleet at Famarn and captures about 1,000 prisoners. 1710, Port Royal, the capital of French Acadia, falls in a siege by British forces. 1775, the Continental Congress establishes the Continental Navy, predecessor to the U.S. Navy. 1792, in Washington, D.C., the cornerstone of the Executive Mansion, known as the White House since 1818, is laid. 1793, French Revolutionary War. Austro-Prussian victory over the Republic in France at the First Battle of Weissenburg. 1812, War of 1812. Sir Isaac Brooks' British and Native forces repel an invasion of Canada by General Rensselaer's United States forces. 1821, the Declaration of Independence of the Mexican Empire is publicly proclaimed. 1843, in New York City, B'nai B'rith, the oldest Jewish service organization in the world, is founded. 1881, the first known conversation in modern Hebrew by Eliza Ben Yehuda and friends. 1885, the Georgia Institute of Technology is founded in Atlanta. 1892, Edward Emerson, Barnard discovers the first comet. discovered by photographic means. 1903, the Boston Red Sox win the first modern World Series. They defeat the Pittsburgh Pirates in the eighth game. 1908, Margaret Travers Simons bursts into the UK Parliament, becomes the first woman to speak there. 1911, Prince Arthur, Duke of Connaught and Strathern, becomes the first Governor General of Canada of royal descent. 1915, First World War, the Battle of Hohenzollern Redoubt marks the end of the Battle of Loos. 1917, the miracle of the sun is witnessed by an estimated 70,000 people in the Cova de Area in Portugal. 13th, 1917. Attended by a large crowd who'd gathered at Fatima, Portugal, in response to a prophecy made by three shepherd children. The prophecy was that the Virgin Mary, referred to as Our Lady of Fatima, would appear and perform miracles on that particular date. Newspapers published testimony from witnesses who said they had seen extraordinary solar activity, such as the sun appearing to dance or zigzag in the sky, careen toward the earth, and emit multicolored light and radiant colors. According to all these reports, these events lasted about 10 minutes. Now, the local bishop opened a canonical investigation of the event in November 1917. Wanted to review witness accounts and assess what the alleged private revelations from Mary were compatible with Catholic theology. If they weren't, then Mary's revelations would be ignored. Catholic theology, of course, was the most important thing. The local priest conducting the investigation, particularly convinced by the recurring testimony of extraordinary solar phenomena from secular reporters, government officials, and other skeptics. Bishop Jose da Silva declared the miracle worthy of belief, October 13, 1930, permitting officially the cult of Our Lady of Fatima within the Catholic Church. At a gathering October 13, 1951, at Fatima, the Papal Legate Cardinal Federico Tedeschini told a million people attending that on October 31st and 1st of November and November 8, 1950, Pope Pius XII himself witnessed the miracle of the sun from the Vatican Gardens. The early and enduring interest in the miracle and related prophecies has had a significant impact on the devotional practices of a lot of Catholics. There are many who believe that they were actually witnessing a UFO because the whoever or whatever the occupants of these vehicles are, they seem to have a fascination with religious practices. Soviet Republic signed the Treaty of Kars to formalize the borders between Turkey and the South Caucasus states. 1923, Ankara becomes the capital of Turkey. 1943, World War II, Marshal Pietro Badoglio announces Italy's officially declared war on Germany. 1944, World War II, Soviet Riga Offensive captures the city. 1946, France adopts the Constitution of the Fourth Republic. 1962, the Pacific Northwest experiences a cyclone, the equal of a Category 3 hurricane. Winds are above 150 miles per hour. 46 people die in this cyclone. 1972, Aeroflot flight 217 crashes outside Moscow. 174 people die. 1972, Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 crashes in the Andes Mountains. 28 survive the crash. All but 16 die before rescue on December 23rd. 1976, the first electron micrograph of an Ebola virus is taken at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention by Dr. F.A. Murphy. Didn't accomplish anything except getting a micrograph. 1977, hijacking of Lufthansa Flight 181 by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine took place on this date. 1983, Ameritech Mobile Communications launches the first U.S. cellular network in Chicago. 1990, Syrian forces attack free areas of Lebanon, removing General Michel Aoun from the presidential palace. 1993, at least 60 people die in eastern Papua New Guinea when a series of earthquakes rocked the Finisterre Range, triggering massive landslides. 2010, the mining accident in Copiapo, Chile, ends as all 33 trapped miners arrive at the surface after a record 69 days underground. 2013, a stampede occurs in India during the Hindu festival Navratri, killing 115 and injuring more than 110. 2016, the Maldives announces its decision to withdraw from the Commonwealth of Nations. 2019, Kenyan Brigid Kosgei sets a new world record for a woman runner with a time of 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 4 seconds at the 2019 Chicago Marathon. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Azerbaijani Railway Day in Azerbaijan. Christian Feast Day. Blessed Alexandrina of Balasar, Daniel and Companions of Coela, Edward the Confessor, Gerard of Arialac, Blessed Madalena Panathiera, Theopolis of Antioch, Doid Takumatsuri in Japan. International Day for Natural Disaster Reduction internationally, Paramedics Day in Poland, Rwagasore Day in Burundi. Okay, what else have we got? October 13th. Well, what's happened here? There we go. 1960, television sets across the U.S. show a split screen with Republican presidential nominee Richard Nixon on one side and Democratic presidential nominee John Kennedy on the other during their third televised debate. They were thousands of miles apart and not in the same studio. This was a first for broadcast. 1972, plane crash survivors in Uruguay resort to cannibalism after being lost in the Andes for 2 months. They admitted they ate the flesh of dead companions to stay alive. Of the original 45 passengers, 16 survived the ordeal and they defended their cannibalism. 1938, heavy Chinese reinforcements are being rushed to Wachau to engage the new large Japanese expeditionary force numbering over 35,000. Fighting is intensifying as the Japanese proceed further inland, trying to gain control over major transport routes, including the railway lines. 1941, the Soviet Union lost 2 more army divisions and demanding British army aid to stop the Germans from reaching Moscow. Hitler continues to make overtures to Britain and the British people. He wants peace between Germany and England. The only reason Germany and England are at war is because of Churchill. 1943, Italy declares war on Germany, its one-time ally. It was granted the status of a co-belligerent by the United Nations. 1952, concerns are growing over the mounting public debt, which is predicted to reach $260 billion by the end of the 1952 fiscal year. 1958, the first of a series of books featuring Paddington Bear is published. A Bear Called Paddington. The first story is about a bear who's found at Paddington Railway Station by the Brown family. The books are written by Michael Bond and illustrated by Peggy Fortum. The much loved stuffed Paddington Bear toy with its Wellington boots didn't appear until 1972. 1966, new laws passed in white control South Africa allow for detention without trial or warrant by a police lieutenant colonel or other high ranking police officer anywhere any person he suspects of security offenses without trial or charge. They can be held for 28 days. 1971, British Army engineers are blowing up several minor roads crossing from the Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland. Currently, the terrorists are using these roads to hop across the border undetected, as most are just small tracks on farmlands. 1976, a chartered Boeing 707 crashed into a busy street in Santa Cruz, a city in western Bolivia. They're plowing in the buildings in the city's main avenue. Over 100 are dead. 1977, four Palestinian hijackers hijack a Lufthansa airliner demanding the release of 11 imprisoned members of Germany's Bader-Meinhof terrorist group, also known as the Red Army faction. Let's see, is anything else? 1988, on this date, the British government lost its battle to stop the publication of the controversial book Spycatcher, written by a former Secret Service agent. 1992, the government's planning to close 31 out of 50 of Britain's deep coal mines with the loss of 31,000 jobs. In the mid-40s, coal mining in Britain employed 1 million miners working in 958 mines. 1997, British fighter pilot Andy Green set a new land speed record of 764.168 miles per hour. That was in the thrust supersonic vehicle going through the sound barrier along a 1 mile course in Nevada's Black Rock Desert. 1999, America becomes the first country to reject the 154-nation nuclear test ban treaty with a vote of 51-48 in the Senate. Most of the countries who signed the agreement don't have nuclear capability, so have nothing to lose and everything to gain by banning nuclear testing by anybody else. 2005, Apple introduced a new iPod capable of playing video at a resolution of 320 by 240, and it's only $299 a month to purchase. 2006, a state of emergency is issued in Buffalo, New York, following nearly 2 feet of snow falling during the afternoon and the night before. 400,000 people are without power and most schools in the area are closed. It's the worst hit area of Tonawanda, New York, Buffalo, and Amherst. A driving ban was issued as up to 80% of the roads are impassable, including parts of I-90. Also in 2006, the Democratic Republic of Congo faced an outbreak of pneumonic plague, killed over 100 people and infected hundreds of others. Let's see, 2008, after suffering a meltdown in the markets in the preceding weeks with the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling below 7,900, it rallies with a gain of 936 points, the highest ever one-day gain. 2008, Iceland stock exchange remained suspended because of continuing unusual market conditions. 2011, an earthquake with a magnitude of 6.1 struck the Indonesian island of Bali. Earthquake damaged some buildings and falling debris injured about 50 people. 2011, King Jigme Khesar Amgyel Wangchuck of Bhutan married a common 21-year-old student by the name of Jetsun Pima during a lavish Buddhist ceremony. It was broadcast on state television within the country. October 13, 2012, a car bomb in a market in Dara Adamkil, Pakistan, killed 15 people and injured another 30. Taliban was blamed for the blast, but nobody had claimed responsibility. And in 2013, Cyclone Phalen strikes parts of India in the Andhra Pradesh and Orissa states. 18 people are reported killed, and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage was done to homes, fields, and infrastructure. 1984, the Apple Macintosh made its appearance in the personal computer market. For $2,500, you can own an Apple Macintosh. And it had a number of interesting features not found in computers in previous decades. Introduced in a commercial during the 1984 Super Bowl. Had 128 kilobytes of RAM. And it had a 3.5-inch floppy disk drive installed. Alrighty. Let's see. Is there anything else? Okay. In 1988, the Archbishop of Turin, Italy, announced the carbon-14 dating indicated the Shroud of Turin, supposedly the cloth in which Christ was wrapped, dates only to the Middle Ages. But the origins are still controversial. 1981, a week after the assassination of Anwar Sadat, voters in Egypt approved Hosni Mubarak as the country's new president. On this day in 1066 was the Battle of Hastings, where King Harold II of England was defeated by the invading army of my ancestor William, Duke of Normandy. It established the Normans as rulers of England. The Saxons became second-class citizens. And in 2007, a dark day in TV history, Keeping Up with the Kardashians premiered, which took some semi-talented young ladies and made them stars and multimillionaires. Alrighty. Well, we've got... The last few shows have been about haunted, or what you'd call the scariest places in the world. Right now, we're going to start talking about threats, plots, and assassination attempts against various presidents. You know, there's been a lot of attempted assassinations that were never given any publicity. According to FDR, since you can't control assassination threats, you just don't worry about them. You know, President Roosevelt was the only president ever elected four times. He led America during the Great Depression and through World War II. Was the target of would-be assassins who threatened to bomb his train, blow up the White House, or just shoot him. Now, a lot of these threats were the rantings of mentally ill individuals, drunks, or attention seekers. But even a drunk can be an assassin. And some of these threats are considered extremely dangerous by FDR's protectors. Now, on the other side of the coin, it was thought that he actually orchestrated the attack on Pearl Harbor to get us into World War II. And there were many who believed that he was extremely sympathetic to the communist rulers of Russia. Now, Roosevelt got an average of 40,000 letters a month at the White House. 5,000 of those, on average, were threatening. And according to the chief of the White House Secret Service detail, the greatest threat to the president came not from the foreign agents or American traitors, but from people who are just nuts. And the most dangerous city for the president was Los Angeles, where Mike O'Reilly, the head of the Secret Service detail guarding the president, said it had more nuts per acre than any other American city. 1937, Roosevelt appointed Frank Wilson, Secret Service chief, He's called the father of the modern Secret Service because he improved the president's security after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And the security procedures he put into effect stayed the Secret Service standard until the 1980s. Now, FDR was popular among the agents that guarded his life. They called him the boss, and he was very protective of the members of his Secret Service team. When you did something for him, according to Michael Riley, he felt it was either a favor or a task well done, and he told you about it. On the other hand, if you screwed up, he let you know he wasn't happy. Now, his detail believed he was a nice guy, but recognized that as one of America's elite, he would never be one of the boys. Though he did actually try. And when he needed to be, he could be extremely ruthless. And he liked to play practical jokes. Secret Service detail was often the target of his jokes. Now, he drove his own car, a Ford Phaeton. Been fitted with hand controls because of his disability. And during these car trips, he would play pranks on his agents and try to lose them on his drives in the country at Hyde Park or Warm Springs, Georgia. On his return, he would ask the head of detail, whose name was Colonel Edmund Starling. He said, I've lost the Secret Service boys. I can't find them anywhere. You know where they are? Now, he was difficult to guard because he was utterly fearless and full of desire to go places and do things that really didn't fit him with being president. Now, he'd been able to walk since contracting polio in 1921. His legs were in steel braces. He called them the painful prison. When he walked, he'd swing one leg in an arc, move forward, and swing the other leg. In his first inaugural speech in March of 1933, he walked 37 paces to a lectern where he made his speech. When he walked to the podium at Philadelphia's Franklin Field to give his acceptance speech to the Democratic Party in 1936, he fell in the mud because, well, the audience was over 100,000. Secret Service agents surrounded him to shield him from photographers. In fact, he fell three times in public during his presidency, but none of these events actually made the news. Now, Roosevelt conceded his paralysis to an audience only a few times throughout his presidency. When he visited a veterans hospital in Hawaii, he stayed in his wheelchair as a way of bonding with the men he commanded. But for the most part, he wanted to project an image of vigor, and he perfected what he calls his splendid deception. Agents covertly propped him up in public, installed a major bar in his touring car, which allowed him to pull himself up and actually stand. Now, a lot of fringe groups made the president a hate figure, including the fascist khaki shirts of America, the fascist silver shirts, the KKK, and a KKK splinter group known as the Black Legion, which was centered in Ohio and Michigan. And it was a group of financiers and industrialists who in 1934 plotted a coup d'etat to prevent him from establishing what they feared to be a socialist state. He's long been viewed as a supporter of socialist policies. Though the media regarded it as a tall tale, retired Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler testified before a congressional committee. The conspirators wanted Butler to deliver an ultimatum to FDR to create a new cabinet officer. That'd be called Secretary of General Affairs, who would run things, and the president would actually be a figurehead. If Roosevelt refused, the conspirators promised Butler an army of 500,000 war veterans who would help drive Roosevelt out of office. Now, the Wall Street, the New York Times came to Roosevelt's assistance and mocked this so-called plot as a gigantic hoax. But it was very true. But the New York Times was such a well-respected newspaper that it actually lied to the American people. Now, while it's true the Congressional Committee's investigation led to no prosecutions, but this testimony is later corroborated by Veterans of Foreign War Commander James Van Zandt and by testimony at congressional hearings. They weren't made public until 1967. And although most historians have dismissed the plot as no more than wild talk, investigative journalist Sally Denton in her book, The Plots Against the President, actually provided compelling evidence that the plotters were actually quite serious. In 1938, 4 years after the plot to topple Roosevelt, a speaker at a Chicago meeting of the Silver Shirt Legion of America was quoted as saying America would have a dictator in less than a year. And if nobody else volunteered to kill FDR, I'll do it myself. Now, the Secret Service came in to investigate, of course. It was decided there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute anybody. According to Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr., great-great-grandson of the wealthy, famous industrials, Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, there was a second plot among industrialists to depose Roosevelt after his unprecedented third term in 1940. And Vanderbilt wrote, I use the term conspiracy. I'm really talking about a plot to capture the president. Vanderbilt said the plan was to impose a firm restraint for the good of the country to hold this dictator, this madman, while some person set up an emergency controls and saved America. Vanderbilt said he informed federal agencies of the plot, and they in turn let him warn those involved in the cabal. As a result of this exposure, the plot never took off. Vanderbilt said FDR knew about the conspiracy. Story wasn't reported until 1959. The then head of the Secret Service, U.E. Bonlin, said he had never heard of the conspiracy. And, of course, FDR's Secret Service Chief Frank Wilson denied any recollection of it. In late 1941, there was more talk of plots against the president when the FBI reported that Ethel Brigham, an America First committee member, said that if Roosevelt took the country to war, a group called the One Gun Club would rise up and revolt. Now, this information was pure rumor, but it didn't stop the FBI from surveilling the Brigham family. FBI agents reported Ms. Brigham attended a New York play where she was observed to make anti-Roosevelt remarks, but nothing was ever said about it publicly. Now, Roosevelt was used to threats against his life. During the First World War, with his Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he was the target of a bomb sent in the mail. Luckily for him, it was discovered before it got to him. He was also in harm's way when anarchists tried to bomb Attorney General Mitchell Palmer's house in 1919. But, like many would-be bombers, they screwed up and blew themselves up when the bomb exploded prematurely. It scattered anarchist literature and leaflets over the landscape. Roosevelt lived across the street from Palmer's home when the bomb exploded, blew all the front windows out on his house. Another bomb threat occurred in April 1929, shortly after he became inaugurated as governor of New York. Bomb was accidentally discovered by a porter, Thomas Callagy, in the parcel room at the General Post Office in New York City. Parcel was addressed to Governor Roosevelt, and the sender's address turned out to be fictitious. The bomb consisted of 6 ounces of dynamite packed in a 6-inch-long pipe that was capped at both ends and contained a fuse with a detonating device. It was embedded in a tin candy box wrapped in brown paper. The detonator was a strip of sandpaper against which 4 matches were held by a spring. Well, as the porter swept the mailroom floor, he accidentally hit the parcel with his broom. It began to hiss and smoke, but it failed to detonate. The porter stepped on the bomb to stamp out the fuse. Police later surmised the device was designed to scare rather than kill, but also believed the bomb might be linked to the burning of Roosevelt's son-in-law's house at Mount Pleasant. Both crimes remained unsolved. Roosevelt was elected president in November 1932. In the 3 months he spent as president-elect, he was the target of an Italian anarchist, another deranged bomber. February 15, 1933, while on a fishing trip with Vincent Astor, he gave an impromptu speech at Miami's Bayfront Park. FDR was in a green Buick convertible, the lead car of a three-car motorcade, with Roosevelt in the Buick with Secret Service agent Gus Jenerick, press aide Marvin McIntyre, and Miami Mayor R.B. Gauthier. FDR didn't leave his car, but stood addressing the crowd, spoke less than 2 minutes. In the audience was Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak, who stepped over to shake Roosevelt's hand. Somebody handed Roosevelt a telegram, and as the president reached to take it, an Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara stood on a chair amid the crowd and opened fire with a nickel-plated .32-caliber double-action revolver. Although the shots missed FDR, a bullet came within 2 feet of his head. Mayor Cermak was hit along with four others in the crowd. Roosevelt told his Secret Service agents to put Cermak in the car and held the fatally wounded mayor on the way to the hospital. Zangara eventually pled guilty to four counts of assault and was sentenced to 80 years in prison. When Mayor Cermak died on March 6, Zangara was tried a second time. He again pled guilty and received the death sentence. During his trial, Zangara said he thought he had the right to kill him. "I see Mr. Hoover, I kill him first. Makes no difference who go get that job. Run by big money. I'm sorry Roosevelt's still alive. I want to shoot Roosevelt." Zangara's self-proclaimed mission was to kill kings and presidents first and next all capitalists. Well, then, Zangara was electrocuted with 230 volts from Rayford Prison's old Sparky surging through his body. He was killed 9:27 a.m. on March 20th. His last words were, "Viva Italia, goodbye to all poor people everywhere. Push the button, go ahead, push the button." Well, many were convinced Zangara had been hired by Chicago gangster Frank Nitti to kill Major Cermak as an act of vengeance. Walter Winchell, the 1930 columnist, for one, believed this rumor to be true. The warden of the prison that held Zangara, however, had a different opinion. He told his guards to write down anything the assassin said, and he also questioned Zangara himself over a period of 10 days. He concluded the guileless assassin, as he called him, was neither insane nor a conspirator, but he had acted alone. Well, the shooting was fully investigated by federal agents, and they could find no link between Zangara and the Chicago mob. The question of a government cover-up might arise, but there's no credible evidence to justify a cover-up taking place in 1933. In fact, if anything, the opposite seemed to be true. The Secret Service, the FBI, the Miami police had discovered Zangara had links to organized crime, terrorist groups, and foreign governments. It seems certain these links would have been hotly pursued. Well, there was also the question of if Zangara had been hired to kill Cermak, why would he do it in the midst of one of the largest crowds ever to gather in Miami history? Cermak had a home in Miami Beach, was vacationing there. And being on vacation, certainly he had many opportunities for a mob hit to take place on him. Well, a month later, Watertown Postmaster George Hooger found a second bomb police determined was similar to the first. A team of Secret Service agents descended on Watertown but failed to identify the bomber. In June of 1933, on the basis of a tip, they arrested 20-year-old Joseph Doldo. The suspect was described as mentally deficient, but he admitted he was the mysterious bomber and told Secret Service agents, "I, Joe Doldo, had done do it. I hate presidents." In August of 1934, 9 sticks of dynamite and a short fuse were discovered in a gulch below a railway trestle outside of Spokane, Washington. Explosives were delivered by a Union Pacific agent who became suspicious of three men he saw. The explosives were discovered by a Union Pacific agent who became suspicious of three men he saw positioning a package at the bottom of the 60-foot ravine. A train carrying the president was scheduled to pass over the bridge. And although several members of a radical organization were suspected of depositing the explosive, no arrests were ever made. In April 1935, FDR was on board a train that crashed into a stolen car near the town of Wilson, North Carolina. Two men were seen to jump out of the car right before the accident occurred. Roosevelt was in the rear of the train, and he didn't even feel the impact. While the FBI investigated the incident, it found no evidence of a plot to derail the train. Throughout the 1930s, Roosevelt was the target of abusive letters, White House phone calls, other threats of violence, some of which led to prosecutions. And one example, in January 1936, 52-year-old Austin Phelps Palmer, mechanical engineer, wrote two letters to Roosevelt, blaming the president for the loss of his million-dollar fortune and threatening his life. In one of the letters, he wrote, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, communist and destroyer of private business. I warn you, if you destroy my business, I'll strangle you with my own hands. May your soul be exterminated in hell. But he was charged with sending threatening letters to the president, pled guilty, admitted to sending letters, and January 24, 1936, was sentenced to 90 days in prison. Well, to the Secret Service, approachers were much more dangerous than letter writers. 1936, as Roosevelt's motorcade traveled through Boston, a man slipped through police lines and ran toward the presidential limousine. He had his fist raised and was shouting, "You dirty son of a bitch." Looked like he's going to throw himself at the president. Secret Service agent Mike Riley jumped from the running board of the president's car and hit the man with a flying body block. Roosevelt later told Riley, "Thank you, you saved me from a punch in the nose." Boston police eventually released the would-be attacker. Police spokesman said the guy was nuts, so he let him go, putting another nut back out on the street. Less humorous, except in retrospect, was an incident in 1936 when a dagger was thrown at Roosevelt who was finishing a speech from the back of a train in Erie, Pennsylvania. Dagger missed the president, but hit an aide standing beside him. Agents quickly surrounded Roosevelt. The dagger turned out to be made of rubber. 1938, Roosevelt once again more threatened by a potential attacker when he traveled in a motorcade. As Roosevelt was driven through Oklahoma City campaigning for the midterm elections, 52-year-old Woody Hockaday broke from the ranks of spectators lining the route and ran toward FDR's car carrying a black shoeshine leather in his hand. Secret Service agent on the running board of the car leapt toward Hockaday and struck him in the face and knocked him down. Firemen and National Guardsmen pinioned Hockaday's arms and then saved him from a mob of infuriated spectators. When Hockaday was searched, it was discovered he wasn't armed. He simply wanted to get close to the president to shine his shoes for a dime and also the shoes of 14 other prominent men to show how much wheat and how little bread the money would buy. Secret Service later judged Hockaday to be a harmless eccentric. No charges are brought against him. Today, he'd be strung up. While Roosevelt expressed no alarm about previous attempts on his life, he did become more security conscious during the Second World War. According to those close to him, he used to talk about what a 25-pound bomb could do to his house in Hyde Park, New York. Now, understandably, special protection was afforded Roosevelt during the Second World War to thwart any would-be Axis assassin. The size of the presidential protection detail reached 16 agents and two supervisors by 1939. After the U.S. entered the war, leading to Roosevelt attending war conferences in Canada, North Africa, Iran, and Yalta, the detail was increased to 37 men. Before the war, White House grounds had been open to the public, welcomed as many as 15,000 visitors a day. Visitors could walk up to the front door and leave a message for the president. Drivers would pass by the North Portico, and anybody could saunter through the North White House grounds without a pass or any challenge from the Secret Service. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, access to the White House was severely restricted. Gates were closed, tourists were banned, and armed soldiers assisted the Secret Service in guarding the Executive Mansion. Invited guests to the White House and dignitaries who met the president on his tours around the country were told to keep their hands out of their pockets. And FDR's food was also tested in case Nazi agents tried to poison him. Excuse me. On one occasion, a fish sent from Cuba was found to be poisoned, but the Secret Service was unable to track down the provenance of the package. There were also a number of breaches in security around the White House. In spite of heightened security, a stranger managed to get into the Executive Mansion, walked to an upstairs hall where a movie was showing, and when the lights went on, asked the president for his autograph. Another concern was German prisoners of war held in the U.S. who were escaping at the rate of 75 a month. That's nothing compared to who's crossing the southern border. FBI Director Hoover believed the escaped prisoners might commit sabotage and espionage, and there was an intelligence report indicating that German prisoners planned a mass escape. One objective was supposed to be to reach and kill Roosevelt. Well, threats that in peacetime might have been ignored or received light sentences were judged more severely during the war, even before the U.S. got into it, after constitutional psychopath Edward de Rohrhoff Blount told acquaintances on two occasions he was going to kill the president. He was arrested and given a 2 to 6 year prison sentence. In a similar case in 1943, a known Nazi sympathizer, William Thomas Reed, was convicted of threatening the life of the president. And just threatening the president is a federal offense. He told a resident, an associate in the oil business, Roosevelt's one guy I hate. If I had the money, I'd go to Washington and kill the president. If you ever come south, I will. More dangerous, perhaps, was Christopher Clarence Call from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was a racist who believed Hitler was the greatest man in the world. Call told friends he wanted to go to Germany, volunteer for special training in sabotage, and return to the U.S. to blow up ships and aircraft factories. Shortly after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, Call enlisted as a soldier in the U.S. Navy but deserted from the USS Florida when it docked at Para in Brazil. Made his way back to America and visited a friend, Dick Siebert, in Belmore, Long Island. He told Siebert he was going to manufacture a nitroglycerin bomb, get close to Roosevelt and blow him to hell, and I'll go along with him. Well, Siebert successfully tried to persuade Quall to abandon his plans, calling the idea preposterous. But according to Siebert, Quall was determined to carry out his plan. When Quall left Siebert's house, he went to New York City and registered at a hotel carrying a case filled with nitroglycerin. Siebert and his mother immediately contacted the police. Siebert said Quall had nearly enough nitroglycerin with him to blow up a battleship. He's a clever mechanic and knows exactly how to make a bomb. He hates Roosevelt and our former government. He's desperate and really intends to carry out his threat. Well, the Secret Service, based on this warning, began a manhunt for Call. The background investigation revealed that Call abandoned his wife, deserted the U.S. Army before deserting the Navy, been arrested for an armed robbery in Tulsa, escaped from a mental asylum in Oklahoma, been indicted for stabbing a shipmate, but it eluded police custody. Secret Service agents eventually discovered Call had taken a room at a New York hotel. They occupied a room directly opposite and arrested him on his return in the early hours of the next morning. He was armed with a 16-inch long butcher knife. In his room, they found bomb-making material. At another hotel, he had also rented a room. They found a black suitcase containing 2 bottles of nitro and a bottle of nitric acid. Call was taken to New York City Police Headquarters. He first denied, but then admitted his purpose was to kill that son of a bitch, Roosevelt. He said, I want to destroy him in order that we can get a new commander-in-chief who will make peace with Germany and go after the Japanese. I hate President Roosevelt. He is responsible for our entry into the war and for killing a great many sailors in the North Atlantic. Call eventually signed a confession stating he planned to strap 3 nitro bombs to his waist. He would wear an army uniform to get close to Roosevelt's car as the president exited the White House, then blow myself and Roosevelt to bits and killing any of those Secret Service agents or other people who were nearby. Well, after Call was sent to a psychiatric hospital, he continued to threaten to kill the president and told the staff he would have no difficulty escaping from the institution. Well, the Secret Service response was to insist that Call be sent to a more secure hospital, the Matteawan State Hospital for the Criminally Insane in Beacon, New York. Arguably, though, the most serious threat to Roosevelt's life occurred shortly before the president set sail for the Tehran-Cairo War Conference. Historians have overlooked this particular threat for the past 70 years. In early November 1943, an armed stalker waited for FDR for 10 days in Lafayette Park across the street from the White House. This particular assassin was Walter Harold Best, a 38-year-old native of Nelson, Wisconsin. After arriving in Michigan in 1938, he married and became the father of 2 small children. And he was employed as a farmhand, a magazine salesman, and at a restaurant. And although he himself didn't serve in the Army during the Second World War, he did have a brother who served in Italy. On November 2nd, 1943, he left home in Pontiac, Michigan, armed with a loaded .38 caliber revolver and 10 additional rounds of ammunition. He arrived in Washington, D.C. November 3rd and registered at the Congress Hotel. He wrote a letter to his wife telling her he intended to get rid of Roosevelt. He learned that the president was out of town, but he intended to wait for his return. Now, the statement the president was out of town at the time was correct. He'd left the White House to travel by train to Hyde Park on October 29th and returned to Washington on November 4th. Best spent the period of November 3rd and November 13th observing the comings and goings of White House staff. He walked around Lafayette Park across the street from the Executive Mansion, hoping to get a pot shot at the president when FDR left the White House to attend church or carry out one of his official duties. He was also aware that Roosevelt often driven in an open limousine and sometimes drove himself in a convertible. The fabric tops of the convertibles that Roosevelt drove had been reinforced to repel grenades, but he often drove with the tops down. And there were certainly numerous opportunities during this period for Best to carry out his attack. On November 6, 2 days after his return from Hyde Park, the president drove to Camp David, then called Shangri-La, and returned to the White House the following day. On November 10th, he drove to National Airport from the White House to meet his returning Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, and returned to the White House at 4 p.m. At 10:40 a.m. on November 11th, his Secret Service protectors drove him to Arlington National Cemetery for a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. He came back at 11:30. At 9:30 p.m. that same day, FDR left the White House to travel by motor car to Quantico, where he boarded the USS Potomac for the first leg of his sea journey to the Tehran-Cairo conference. Now, the dangers of Roosevelt traveling in an open-top convertible weren't lost on Kenneth Seckel, who was a captain of the White House police force. Seckel recorded driving one day from Hyde Park, the president's home, to FDR's mother's apartment in New York. He said, "We had about 20% of the police force in New York involved in the president's protection." He said, "I got out of the car and there were 1,000 people all over the neighborhood. I said to one of the Secret Service men, if anybody wanted to take a pot shot, there wasn't much could be done." Well, in Best's letter to his wife, he told her he'd infiltrated a group of soldiers who were unloading a truck at a White House gate. He said the soldiers were busy, which made it possible for him to gain access to the White House. But as he deliberated whether or not to steal the soldier's rifle lying on the ground nearby, he was discovered and walked away. It turns out his account was partially confirmed in 1966 when former Secret Service Director Frank Wilson said an unnamed would-be assassin had stolen a rifle from White House armed sentries. The next day it was found in a flower box at the back of the State Department building. The soldiers were severely disciplined for their serious lapse of duty. Well, as you might guess, Best's wife contacted the police or relayed her information to the Secret Service on November 13th. That same day, Best was ticketed for jaywalking, was abusive to the police officer, and was arrested. At the police station, he was eventually identified as wanted by the Secret Service. Well, Best wasn't armed when he was arrested, but Secret Service agents discovered the pistol and bullets in his hotel room. During his interrogation, Best admitted he'd been stalking President Roosevelt. He said, "I had retros running to my brain," he told agents. "They told me to get rid of Roosevelt." On November 23, 1943, 10 days after his arrest, he was judged insane and sent to Gallagher Hospital in Washington before being sent to a Michigan psychiatric hospital. Well, on November 14th, one day after Best was arrested, FDR was nearly killed when he was aboard the USS Iowa bound for the Tehran-Cairo conference. At about 8 a.m. during an air defense drill, there was a shattering explosion close by the battleship. Iowa's captain saw the wake of a torpedo and promptly heeled his ship to port, making a 90-degree turn. The torpedo missed the ship by just 20 feet. Fearing that German submarines were attacking, the president's security detail prepared to take the president off the ship on a lifeboat. A few minutes later, an escort ship reported that a live torpedo had been fired by accident. Had the captain not made that maneuver, the torpedo would have struck the Iowa directly below FDR's quarters. According to Soviet agents, Waffen-SS commander Otto Skorzeny, Hitler's favorite cloak and dagger operative, also had Roosevelt in his sights. Skorzeny allegedly had been given the mission of assassinating FDR, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin when the Big Three met for a conference in Tehran in November 1943.
Well, Tehran had been chosen by Stalin for the meeting because it was close to the Soviet Union and the Red Army bases of northern Iran. But Tehran was filled with German agents eager to tap into anti-British sentiment. Stalin informed FDR of the plot, codenamed Operation Long Jump, persuaded FDR to stay at the Russian embassy where it was safer. In Tehran, U.S. General Herbert Norman Schwarzkopf and his British counterpart, Colonel Joseph Spencer, put their subordinates on alert for Skorzeny's assassins. All but six of the 38 German commandos who'd parachuted into Tehran were rounded up. The remainder captured 3 months later. The Russians executed all of them. Roosevelt said the plot, if successful, would have been a pretty good haul, and Churchill was excited and even pleased when he heard his life had been threatened. He looked into everybody's face with the happiest sort of suspicion. He never knew who he could trust. Not everybody believed the plot was real, though. America's ambassador to the Soviet Union, Averell Harriman, suspected the Russians had cooked it up. Additionally, the British Joint Intelligence Committee of the War Cabinet concluded the Nazi plot against the Big Three was a complete baloney. But keep in mind that Skorzeny admitted it after the war. Initially, Skorzeny himself denied the existence of any plot. Western historians have also been skeptical, but Skorzeny eventually admitted the plot in 1966. And Russian sources continue to insist the plot really did exist. 2007, one of the KGB operatives involved in the attempt to stop the alleged assassination plot stated flatly the success for our group in locating the Nazi advance party and our subsequent actions thwarted an attempt to assassinate the Big Three. British author Charles Whiting in his book, Target Eisenhower, provided compelling evidence for the Russian case. Hans Gergen Eisenheim, a former German paratrooper who after the war became a U.S. Army employee in Bonn, Germany, said he was a member of a handful of chosen German paratroopers who were ordered on a suicide mission to kill Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt when they met at the Yalta Conference in February of 1945. The German Air Force base where the plot was organized was near the Russian front and was attacked before the mission could take off. The conspirators were pressed into defending the base and half of them were killed, and that pretty much ended the plot. Now, Roosevelt didn't die from the bullet of an assassin, but from the burden he had undertaken as the war president. In April 1945, he went south to his Warm Springs home in Georgia, the Little White House, as it was called. It was accompanied by his friend Elizabeth Shumatov, an artist who was to paint his portrait. On the morning of April 12th, 1945, FDR complained to his doctor about a slight headache and stiffness in his neck. As he posed for his picture and spoke to his mistress, Lucy Rutherford, he went through his wallet and tossed his draft card in the wastebasket. He had carried it with him throughout the war. He said later, "I have a terrific headache," and slumped forward. He died 2 hours later in his small bedroom. So in spite of all the attempts to assassinate him, it was what amounted to natural causes. We'll talk more about attempted threats and plots and assassination attempts on presidents in future shows, but for right now, we come to the end of the tonight's show. Until tomorrow, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.